Blog Talk Radio.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block long limousine, EO11. EO11. Someday I'll have me a penthouse, stacks and stacks of Bowling Green. EO11, EO11, it's all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place down there or heaven. In the meantime, EO11. Show me a man without a dream, and I'll show you a man that's dead, real dead. Once I had me a dream, but that dream God kicked in the head. Dream dead. I nearly had me that chauffeur and that block long limousine, EO11. I nearly had me that penthouse, all them stacks of Bowling Green, E11. Some judge is gonna say I'm putting you away for
I love that song, man. Okay, I'm not trying to take anything away from Dean. As you guys know, my feelings on Dean. Same thing with Frank. Sammy, I just don't think had the spotlight shown on him quite bright enough. From Ocean's 11, EOM, Sammy Davis Jr., and from here deep in the mountain state of West Virginia, for a conservative perspective, I'm James Bostic. Welcome. It's Thursday night, and we do it live, as you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays. We go live 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we also have a recorded version of the program that goes out over the Mojo 50 Radio Network. And you can go to mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you really should be. The very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio out amongst them anywhere. And ACP is proud and a little bit humbled to be moving through that rarefied air. Kathleen Willie is a name you guys, you know it. Juanita Broderick, another name you guys know. And these women, as I said in the teaser, you know, they were made famous, the household names, and I'm pretty sure had absolutely no intention of ever being household names under any circumstances, let alone the ones through no fault of their own they found themselves in. Well, tonight we're going to talk about another name that we're going to add to that. And this lady's name is Leslie Cruzan Milwee, and she was a youngster. She's barely 20 years old, I guess. Back in 1980, when the story that she's about to tell you took place. Yes, she is yet another of the victims of, as I also said in the teaser, she is a victim of probably one of the most storied sexual predators in American history. And this is a very powerful and at times kind of scary story that she's going to share with us. Again, her name is Leslie Cruzen Millweed. We have her here, and we're honored to have her here. Ms. Millweed, welcome to A Conservative's Perspective.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Really happy to have you here. You know, our friends, Don Ewan and Donna Fiducia, you know, I asked Don to give me some background, a little bit more background than the Reader's Digest version that he had given me when he suggested that you'd be an awesome guest. And I listened to the interview that you did with Don Ewan and Donna Fiducia, and boy, that's and as I told you, as we've talked back and forth, that what a compelling story, what a powerful story. And I know that our listeners tonight are really going to be, they're going to be entranced to hear this. And what I would like for you to do is I'm going to give you the floor, Ms. Millweed. I'm going to let you tell your story. They have enough of the background on what you're doing here, and we can talk a little bit about why it's so important to spread this word, as if we don't already know. But I'm going to yield the floor to you, and once again, we're so happy to have you here to share this story.
Well, thank you. You and I talked a little bit briefly. You know, the mainstream media, they were forced to cover me for a very short time when I came out in 2016 to tell my story, but and thank goodness, or some part of me regrets that I wasn't more supportive of these other women and didn't come forward faster. But let me just give you a little background about myself. I was born and raised in Tulsa, and I worked for a professional soccer team, and I had a lot of media contacts. I was just a young pup. I graduated when I was 17 from high school, so I was attending college and working for this team. Had a lot of media contacts. Long story short, there was an opening for a reporter in Fort Smith, Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I was kind of offered the job through all my connections and interviewed and got the job, and later did anchoring and news reporting. And it was a really consequential time, everything lined up, unfortunately for me, and the fact that I went to Arkansas and the Fort Chaffee crisis happened immediately, where all the flotilla came over from Cuba, where Castro basically emptied his prison. And as a result, the base, which was right outside of Fort Smith, Arkansas, became my beat. It became the place I went every single morning to get a story, because it was very controversial, especially after a few months, because these people were supposed to be brought in. They were refugees, and then they were going to be filtered out from this base that had been there since World War II. It was the only place large enough in that region to house all of these refugees. Most of them were criminals, a lot of political prisoners, a lot of religious persecution.
Now,
but it was just
the time frame that you're talking about here. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was just going to say,
no,
what you're talking about here is this is the Cuban boat lift, and that was 1980, right?
Correct.
Okay.
It
all right.
Started
How old
were
you in 1980?
I was 20 years old. I actually started the job when I was 19 and turned 20 right after I started. And I was kind of put in a hotbed right off the bat. Here I am. I'm
right.
This really nice Baptist green girl. I mean, I was smart enough, but I didn't have any life experience. And so I was kind of forced into this situation where I had to deal with Governor Bill Clinton quite a bit. That became my beat for some reason. I don't know if I threw the short straw or I was good. I still can't figure it out. So I had to go to Fort Chaffee every morning and do interviews. And Bill Clinton spent about 2 or 3 days a week there, because it was a real big political issue for him. He actually ended up losing the governorship later that year because of everything that had happened, and was defeated. But so he's a first-term governor, and I was kind of forced to see him quite frequently. And I have to tell you, from the moment that we met, and if I remember correctly, I was interviewing him this first time, and he was very friendly, and I felt immediately uncomfortable. I felt like he was, you know, really kind of trying to get something and going, and I immediately, you know, shut it down. I was nothing but professional. I, you know, did my job, did my interviews, and went home. And it was within a month or two after seeing him four or five times and doing several interviews, it was very obvious that he had singled me out. And he would actually come into the TV station where I worked, and we all had our little cubicles, and you know, there were probably 10 or 15 of us in a room at any given time, and he would always go right to me and, you know, rub the back of my shoulders if I was sitting down or something like that. Just made me very uncomfortable. And, of course, no one in the newsroom thinks anything about it. You know, this is a Southern, you know, good time guy that's just friendly to everybody and loved by everyone. So I didn't really, even though it made me very uncomfortable, I kind of just let things slide. And people, you know, my news director and other people would joke and say, hey, I think he really likes you. You know, he comes in and singles you out. And I said, well, you know, I know that and I don't like it. So I was very aware of it and conscious of what was happening in that regard. So this one particular day, he was in the news station, and we'd had a riot at Fort Chaffee, so he was going to be around. And I went into this little room to do my editing. That was back in the days when there was B-roll, and you had to put your own story together. And for those of you that aren't familiar with it, we were basically in a closet. It was a windowless area that was probably an 8x8 room, and it had desks all the way around it except for the door opening where the door was. And you pulled your chair up to it, and there were probably five or six different kinds of machine. You could lay audio. You could splice your video together. So it was very basic back then. You know, it was right before we started going with live shots. So I'm putting my story together, and the room is so small, the desk and the chair literally bump up to the door behind you when you're working. It's very small. So I heard the door open this first time, and I was working, and immediately I heard the door close, which is really hard to have somebody stand behind you and you still sit up to the desk and work. It was very crowded. And I kind of turned my head to see who it was that had come into the room, and it was Clinton. And he took he basically pushed me into my chair. He took his hands, put them on my shoulders, and started running them down my chest to my breast, grabbing my breast. And then he starts to put his genitals right against my neck and is holding me down. And of course, first I'm flabbergasted. You know, it's like, you know, you're thinking, what is happening? You know, it's, your mind can't wrap, you know, around what's happening. So I immediately grabbed his hands with my hands in the front, and I'm trying desperately to push him off of me. And the harder I push, the harder he pushes down on me and is literally humping me from behind. And I know, and, you know, I'm thinking, what can I do? And I started to cry, and I'm begging him. I said, please don't do this to me. I don't want this. I don't want you. The ironic thing, Chelsea was literally weeks old. She had just been born the first time this happened. And I had done a story about his baby the week before, and I said, you know, you have a new baby. You have a wife. Please leave me alone. I do not want this. And he did it for, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 minutes, which seemed like an eternity. Then he started laughing, and he's laughing when I'm begging him not to do this to me. He turns around, opens the door, and walks out. So I'm just sitting there stunned, thinking, what, you know, what can I do? Of course, first I'm just so shaken, but then I get angry. And I think, what just happened to me? That can never happen again. So it was probably 5 to 10 minutes later. I walk outside the room, and I look out. We have a huge windows outside in the front of the station, and I see him walking toward the car to get in the car to leave. And lo and behold, I open the door, and I'm so angry. I ran up to him, and I'm pretty sure I stuck my finger in my face and I said, in his face, and I said, don't you ever do that to me again. Don't you ever touch me. And he laughed. And then I looked up and there is a highway patrolman waiting to escort him back to wherever he's going. And I thought, who do I tell? Who's going to believe me? He's riding in the car with this highway patrolman. He's just assaulted me. And I can't do a darn thing about it. He's laughing at me when I tell him to stop. So I contemplated whether or not, you know, I should share my story. My news director was a woman, and she was awesome. But, you know, there's a level of embarrassment with it. There's a level of self-doubt. You know, what did I do to make this person do this to me, kind of thing. So my grandmother was my... You know, I could just share anything with her. She was a wonderful human being. She helped a lot in my upbringing. And even though I was close to my mother, I was really close. And she lived in a small town in Oklahoma. And I called her and I told her what happened. And, of course, she was mortified. There was no doubt she knew that it had happened to me. But she says, you know, honey, I don't want you to go forward because there's no good that's going to come out of it for you. Even if they do believe you, so what? You know, she said, let me tell you what. This is really breaking my heart. She had just retired a few months before. She said, why don't I lock my house up here and I will come to Arkansas and I will live with you? Because I was terrified. I said, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to me? You know, and so God bless her. She loaded up and came over to Arkansas to be with me and stay with me. And a couple of weeks went by and I thought, it was really weird. The next time I saw him, he just acted like nothing had happened, of course. And I'm very weary but nothing was said. So I continued to do my stories. I really made an incredible effort to not ever be around him, that I didn't have to be, or to be around him in the company of other people. Because I thought, if nothing else, I can help control the situation so that it doesn't ever happen again. So a few weeks later, I'm sitting at my desk, and I have one of those long little notebooks that are called reporter's notebook. And I say, I'm sitting there. It has my name written on it, Leslie, and I hear him come into the station and start talking to people. And he walks over to me in my little cubicle, puts his hands on my shoulder, and he takes my pen out of my hand and writes the word Clinton right above my name. And I said, what are you doing now, giving me your autograph? And he said, no, honey, I want to show you how good Clinton looks on top of Leslie. And he did stuff like that all the time. He would come up and try to whisper in my ear. And, it was disgusting.
God, it's terrible.
I was mortified, you know, and I was in fear. I'm like, what, you know, is the shoe going to drop? So, you know, I kind of grew into some false hope. You know, my grandmother said, you went out and you really gave him the business and told him not to do that again. And he laughed, but, you know, he's macho and maybe that's what it is. And maybe he's never going to do that again. So I had to continue seeing him. I didn't say anything to anyone except my immediate family. And I was in the station. I had gone back to do my story and I hear him come in the door and I just cringed. So I knew he was in the building. There was no lock on the door. Believe me, I would have locked it. And sure enough, he comes in. He does the very same thing he did to me the first time, only this time it's much more violent. He holds me down and he humps me to the point of ejaculation. And I'm crying the whole time. I'm just beside myself.
Jeez.
I know. And I, I'm begging him the whole time, get out. And he finally gets out. And so I vowed to myself, I'm like, I don't know what I can do. I don't know how I can do it, but I've got to make sure that that man never knows I'm alone in this room again. And I had to edit my own stories. I mean, I couldn't say I refused to do that part of my job. It was an integral part of what I did. So the very last time it happened, I I didn't even have any knowledge that he was in the building. He was not in the building when I went into the room. And this was probably a month after the second time. And he comes in and I can hear him outside saying, "Where's Leslie?" And he just makes a beeline right for the door. I know he's coming down the hall. I'm bracing myself. I'm like, this is not going to happen again to me. He is not going to do this. He comes in physically, forcefully, holds me against the desk, does the same thing that he did the second time. I'm just beside myself. He turns around. He laughs at me and walks out. And he said, "I'm going to be president one day, little girl. You better figure that out, you know, sweetie, because you're going to go places if you're part of this. You're fighting this, but we're going to be together, and this is going to happen." And I'm thinking, what kind of a fantasy world, what kind of crazy is this man that I'm sitting there begging him to stop, and he's saying wow. these things to me, you know? So I don't even think I finished editing my story at that point, or maybe I was finished. I grabbed my purse and I ran home, hopped in my car and got home. And my grandmother was there and I just started sobbing. And I said, you know what? I'm going to have to leave this job. This man is not going to leave me alone. I'm kidding myself if I think it is. And if I go forward, I'm going to lose my job because so what? You know, I'm this, you know, junior reporter, and I, you know, this is the governor of Arkansas. So my grandmother and I had just about gone to bed. We were ready for bed. We had turned the lights off and we're still sitting in my living room talking. And we hear somebody come up the stairs. I lived upstairs in an apartment, and he starts knocking on my door. And this is like at 10:30 the night that he does this.
Governor Clinton, Bill Clinton, the same night this happens, he's followed you home.
He's followed me home, and he is knocking on my door. And I was petrified. And we didn't have a peephole in it, but there was a big window, and we could kind of look around in the dark. There was a kind of a street lightish thing not very far, and we could see him. And he started talking and said, "Leslie, I know you're in there. Open up. I want you to open this door." And then he became more aggressive. "You need to open this door for me. I've got to talk to you." So I was just, you know, freaked out. So I went in the next day. I gave he eventually left. After about 5 or 10 minutes, he pounded on my door until someone downstairs actually came out to see what was going on. That's how obnoxious he was being. So he left. I went in the next day. I quit my job abruptly. Everybody was stunned at the TV station. And I almost told my news director, but, you know, I was like, what good is it? I'm not going to stay here. So I left abruptly. I went back to, you know, it changed the course of my life. That had been my major in college, and that's what I wanted to do. And I abruptly changed. I'm very lucky that I'm strong and I'm able to deal with a crisis or life-changing events. But to say that it hasn't scarred me and changed who I am somewhat, that's certainly true. So I loaded up, went back to Oklahoma. I ended up getting married. And about a year or so later, I met my husband and I told him, and he was so wonderful. That's one of the most endearing things that I love about my husband of 38 years is he told me then that after I told him what had happened, he said, "If you want to tell this story tomorrow, or you want to tell your story in 10 years or 50 years, I will be there for you and I will support you 100%. So I've had it. I almost came forward in 1998, and during the Monica Lewinsky thing, I have some guilt that I didn't support Juanita, and I didn't because she's become a really good friend of mine, and Kathleen Willey as well, and that I didn't support Paula Jones and the whole thing. But and I don't compare myself. Sometimes people will say, "Oh, like Monica Lewinsky." No, I didn't choose to ever have anything to do with that man. Never. Jennifer Flowers, I didn't choose to you know, have any kind of relationship with him. So I always want to clarify that. Now, Kathleen was fondled. Juanita was raped. And, you know, the incredible thing is the timeline. You know, we know pretty sure that he raped somebody in England when he was there on a Rhodes Scholar, as a Rhodes Scholar. He raped Juanita in 78. This happened to me in 1980. There are other people that we know that are probably from 82, 83, and then the list just goes on. You know, then it's just a long progression of sexual assaults and rapes this man has committed. And I was really hoping when this Harvey Weinstein and Epstein thing came on, because you know they're all connected. I mean, there's no question.
Yes.
We're talking Lolita Express with all those guys.
Right.
You know, you hold out some hope, and I have to say Juanita's been my realistic, get back to realization person, because, you know, she's like, these people have been untouchable. And when I met her, when I came forward in 2016, it was really weird how I decided to come forward. I might say that when all the Monica Lewinsky stuff was happening, I hadn't really told anybody out, like I said, outside my direct immediate family. And I ended up, I had a very good friend. He was my husband's best friend, and she was one of my best friends, and she was a psychologist. So when all this is happening, she knows something's wrong, and I share this with her, and she was a wonderful help to me for many years. And she since passed away, but what a blessing she was in my life. As a result, this man, who happens to be the most liberal Democrat you've ever met on the planet, I tell him this story. And, of course, he's a good friend of ours. We love him, and he loves us. And he was mortified and so sad that all this happened. So, ironically, he's one of my witnesses. I ended up telling another really best friend, two, actually, during that time. But other than that, I pretty much kept it to myself. I had these very, you know, small group of people because I really didn't want it to get out. I don't know that I could have dealt with that in the 90s. I'm a strong, mature woman now. I have my career. I don't worry about. I was in the medical industry at the time in pharmaceuticals when all that was happening in the 90s. And I thought, you know, I'm a woman in pharmaceuticals. I'm going to get raked over the coals for this. I'm going to lose my career and my income. And, you know, no good's going to come out of that for me. And I even talked about that with my Democratic friend. He's like, you're right. You know, Clinton is beloved here. You're not going to win on that. So, time passes, and I'm sitting in my recliner in February of 2016, and I say to myself, I'm looking at the TV, I'm watching Fox News, and I realize that Hillary Clinton is going to be the 2016 nominee for the president. And I just had this strong, incredible wave come over me that I had to come forward. And I told my husband that night, I woke him up. This was pretty late. I said, I have to tell people because Hillary is going to be in the office and I'm going to have to look at that man 8 more years and I just can't do it. And he said, well, honey, you know, think about it. And I said, you know, I'm going to pray about it. I'm going to think about it. So that was February. And out of the blue, it was so bizarre. I hadn't spoken to a friend of mine who worked at NBC, the national network during the Fort Chaffee thing that I had kept in touch with very briefly over 20 or 25 years. You know, we would talk maybe once every 2 or 3 years. Out of the blue, this guy calls me and he says, can I ask you something? And I said, of course. He said, did Bill Clinton sexually assault you? I felt like there was something really bad there. And I said, yes. And I told him and he said, listen, I'm a friend of Sean Hannity. I'm going to call him, and I want you to tell him your story. And I said, I don't know. Let me think about this. So a couple of days later, it's Sunday evening, and I get a call, and it's Sean Hannity's producer. And she says, look, I heard your story. I hope you don't mind that he shared your phone number with me, but man, you know, you've got to tell your story. And so I said, you know, I just don't know if I'm ready to hit that stage like that. I let me think about it. So my grown son was living in Baltimore at the time, and he got incredibly deathly sick. He got pneumonia and was in the hospital for more than a month. So I kind of took that as a sign that, you know, it wasn't meant to be. I ended up leaving my job, for taking a short leave of absence and going to, you know, nurse him back to care. And he got better. So now it's July or August. And I get a call from Hannity's producer, and they say, we have a really great guy. He works for Breitbart. His name is Aaron Klein. And he so desperately would love to talk to you. Will you at least talk to him? It's, you know, it's a more of a digital platform versus, you know, TV and radio. And I said, well, I'll tell the story, but, you know, I just don't know if I'm still ready. So he called me. We ended up talking for probably four or five different times for hours. He hooked me up with Juanita and with Kathleen to kind of talk things through about expectations if I came forward right before an election. And, you know, I told them, I've got to think on this. I know this could be life-changing. It probably won't be because I don't really matter. But, you know, okay. So he set me up to come to New York on October the 19th of 2016. I told him my story to a camera. He posted it. It was on Breitbart News. I had never told the story from beginning to end. And I can't tell you what a rush of emotion that was. And I look up and there's, you know, a couple of cameramen and Aaron and three or four other people, and they're all crying. And I was so overwhelmed. And I was happy that I told my story, because I hadn't realized that from start to finish, I had never really gone down that road. So went back to my room. This was at 4 or 5 in the afternoon. He said, it's going to hit Breitbart News at midnight tonight. The story will. So I just want you to know your life could change. Just know this. I said, okay. And so a couple of hours later, I get a phone call, and it is from Steve Bannon. And he says, just want you to know the president and I just watched your show, your interview, and the president wants me to tell him how very sorry that you had to deal with that. And there is a debate tomorrow in Las Vegas. Would you like to go there? I said, I would love to. So the story hit. Hannity picked it up right away. I was on Hannity, I think, the next day or the day after. Flew to Las Vegas. I was in an interesting van. I started getting death threats immediately. Isn't that rich? Don't you just love it? On Facebook, people are looking me up, and you should die, whore, and all this. And, you know, I'm just like, are you kidding me? So, but I'm thicker skinned now. I kind of found it amusing on some level.
But still, it's got to be unsettling just the same. You know, the Clintons are at the height of the point in time right now that you're talking about, this window. The Clintons are at the height of their power in terms of influence all over the world, not here just in the United States, but they're powerful and influential people, because she's running for president, and yeah, they got people, you know, they got people.
Exactly. And obviously they've used these people in the past. You know, we know about the archetypes,
right,
as we call it here. So
absolutely.
So I'm in the limo going into the event in Las Vegas, and I am with the fiance of Christopher, Ambassador Stevens, Christopher Stevens. His fiance Liddy is in there with me. Barack Obama's brother was in there with me, two Secret Service guys, actually, and also one of the parents of the other people that were killed in Benghazi. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm watching, and we're waiting. We get there like an hour before, you know, it starts. They won't let us in. they will not let us in. Then they let us into the gate, and they say they have to sweep the car. Secret Service literally shut us out. And I finally got in. Then they tell me I couldn't go into the convention center because I had a purse with me. And I'm like, no, this is not happening. And it was so ironic. Sarah Palin and her husband Todd were right there coming in. And she kind of gestured me, come on. This, she said, I won't repeat what she said. This is a bunch of BS, and we're not going to take it. You have a badge. Come on. So I went in, and as a result, we were about 2 or 3 minutes late. I was set. My set place was to sit beside Sarah Palin and catty corner from Bill Clinton. And I'm telling you, I was excited. I could not wait to give that man the stink eye, if nothing else. You know, I was excited. It was like 35 years of pent-up anger, you know. And so I'm walking to my seat. A Secret Service man stops me, and he says, you're not going to sit there. I said, yes, yeah, it's my seat. Look, look. He said, no, you don't understand. You're not sitting there. And he took Lydia and I by the hand, and he moved us to the back of the area onto one side and would not let me sit in my place for the debate that I had been designated. And I was furious. And I went up to a couple of them later because they watched me. I think they were afraid I was going to flee and go up there. And I said, look, I know you're getting your orders from Hillary, and she's despicable, and shame on you. Shame on you for doing that. And, of course, they can't say anything. So I got to meet President Trump and his family and everyone after. I had some run-ins with some reporters that wasn't very pretty from the New York Times, and just some really repulsive people who basically said things like, now, what do you think you did that made him do that to you? You know, it's
blaming you.
Crazy. Yeah. You know,
oh, man.
Well, you know, we've seen the interview, and you were, you know, maybe you did something to make him think that. And I'm like, sexual assault is never okay like that. And I said, you know, you can turn your cheap shoes around and walk the other way because I'm not talking. So I did a whole lot of, I probably did 40 or 50 or 60 interviews between then and the campaign. I did Breitbart, Hannity, Megyn Kelly, a whole bunch. And I was really well received, and I think my story is very believable. It doesn't change. It's very etched in my mind. But nobody in the mainstream media wants to talk about that. And, you know, poor Juanita, this woman has been through 35 years of blowing the whistle on this man, or 30 years, and no one, you know, they won't listen to her either because it's true. And I'm so glad I kept that notebook that he wrote his name on top of mine. I kept a piece of tie that he cut off of himself one day at a bridge dedication, kind of took me aside in front of, you know, 200 people and said, hey, you're going to need to keep this because I'm going to be president and you're going to wish you were with me. I mean, just so obnoxiously irreverent.
Creepy.
And yeah, he's crazy. So
wow.
He really is. I used to think he was just, you know, I think when you get that much power and there's absolutely no accountability, and it's evil anyway. So, I mean, there's just this force of evil about both of them that I'm very aware of when I look at him. Now, he looks like he's about to die of AIDS. I don't know what's going on with him, but he looks dreadful, doesn't he?
Well, you know, we talked about that earlier. And, yeah, and if you take into effect this this indulgent and consumptive life that he's led, yeah, it would be, you know, it would be no surprise if that were the case. But he's, yeah, he's probably, it's no telling what all he's got eating him up. And you're right. It seems that these people, I mean, it apparently, based, you know, on what we've seen up to this point, and there have been lots of stories, and there's no shortage of examples of the evil of these two people, of Bill and Hillary Clinton, because of their ambitions, because of their greed, because of their avarice, because of their lust you know, their lust for power. But it just
and
seems
money.
That there's not going to be any judgment here. And I think that that's
right.
What's so frustrating to so many people, because, you know, we would like to see that justice meted out here. which honestly,
I know.
You know, but this justice is going to be nothing compared, as severe as it could be on Earth, it's going to be nothing compared to what they're going to meet in the end. And that, and I know that that's probably little comfort to folks like you and to Kathleen and to Juanita Broderick and all the other victims of this creep. And you just wonder sometimes about the reality of it. I mean, they're out of power now. They're still political royalty, I guess, in the Democrat family, as it exists now. But, you know, as time passes, they're going to fade from importance and from influence. But still, you know, you would think that by the time they got to that weakened condition, that there would be someone somewhere that would say, okay, it's obvious you people have broken the law, and we've got the mechanisms in place, the subpoenas, the grand juries, and we've worked everything. You know, you're under arrest. We want to see that
right.
So bad. I know you want to see that, and there are a lot of people that want to see it. And I just... But the truth of the matter is we're probably never going to see that perp walk happen, and we're just going to have to take comfort in the fact that the judgment that they face, you know, the judgment they avoid here
forever.
Is going to be so
yeah.
much worse later on.
That's right, yeah. And, and that's what I have to comfort myself with. I mean, I'm a realist, and I know that. And, again, you're hopeful when you see somebody like Weinstein. Somebody
right.
said, yeah, he tested positive for the COVID-19 virus. And I said, well, my question would be, what poor person did he take that test away from? We don't care if he has COVID-19. I mean, really? He took a perfectly good test and it was wasted on him? I mean, you know, and the way, I mean, he's been in and out of the hospital, and you see how he gets special treatment, and of course what the Clintons, there's so much documented evidence. I'll tell you, I've had a couple of reporters who are extremely left-leaning, and I'm very leery of them. But one guy in particular who worked for the Weekly Standard, and he's written several articles about Juanita and I together and then separately. And, you know, he is over the Clintons. He just would love to see justice. And, you know, that was hard for me to wrap my head around, because I get such pushback. You know, Democrats
right.
take a pass. You know, oh, well, you know, well, they want, you know, they had affairs with him. No. He raped and sexually assaulted many women. And you know, there's a fear factor there. You know, I was talking to my husband about that not long ago. You know, I had little kids when all this was going down about Monica Lewinsky. I was not going to risk my 5 and 6 or 7 year old kids for this. You know, I was not going to have them harassed, or my husband. So, you know, we all make choices, and, you know, it's probably best the way it came out, you know, because I was very, very drawn and overwhelmed to present my story when I did. So I have to believe it's the way God wanted it to go down and the way it was meant to be. So I'm good with that. I just wish more people would actually listen and, you know, give more credence to many of these victims.
In terms of your healing from this, and granted, you know, it was a long time ago, and there are people that would use that argument, you know, but this was this is the second time I've heard your story, and it still, you know, resonates so negatively with me, because of what happened to you and the way you were victimized. And in terms of your healing, I guess is what I want to get at is, when you finally told that story, as you said, from beginning to end, and you started that catharsis, have you found that it became easier to tell this story as you, and I know you've done it many, many times, have you found it easier to do so? And how do you see yourself in terms of healing from this point as opposed to that time before you actually, recounted it from start to finish?
I will say there was an incredible amount of relief after I did it. It was, I had no idea that it was so pent up in me. It's something I'm a good person to be able to put everything in a little neat compartment and deal with it. And as a Christian, I found a lot of strength in that and prayed about it a lot. And, you know, there were days when I wouldn't think about it at all. And there were days when I saw that man and I had to watch his presidency and then watch her and then watch, you know, it was overwhelming and I would get teary. But more than anything, I would get angry. And I don't think I have that anger so much. I honestly can't say I forgive him for what he did, because I don't think there's been any kind of acknowledgement of anything he's done. And he needs to be put away, but it's not who I am. I never let it dictate who I am in my life or what I did. And I made that deal with myself many, many years ago, about the same time that I got married. Yes, it was a horrible thing. Yes, it changed my life. But if that hadn't happened, maybe I wouldn't have met my husband and had my children and had my career like I loved and met the people that I had in my life. So, you know, there's a silver lining to everything. And I think you have to look at life like that. We're all thrown curveballs, some of them worse than others, and some people deal with them better. And I won't say who, but there's one woman in the group that I had contact with, and I love her dearly, and it has defined her life. She still has lots of anxiety about it, and I love her dearly, and I feel for her because he's not victimizing me again. You know, he did for a while, but I made the choice that it's my life. He has no power over me anymore, and he never will. There's never anything that could happen that's going to give him power over me again. And I don't know if he has ever listened to one of my interviews. I hope it's been thrust in his face. But, you know, I hope that he has heard what a victim feels like. And it probably doesn't matter. It's probably still funny to him. And he's probably even more callous and crazy than he ever was. But, you know, I hope he hears it. I hope Juanita is in his, you know, mind and face, because God love her. She never gives up. She is just like on a mission. And I love that about her. And, you know, she's a big part of why I'm still doing interviews. I work in healthcare and I work a lot with hospice patients and in the medical industry. And, you know, we're at different places in our life. She's retired and I'm still actively working. And, you know, I said, it's not going to define me. It's not going to change how I do things or why I do things. I'm not going to allow that. And she's good with that. But I also want to support her and the other victims. It was real funny. The Me Too movement didn't count for us, unfortunately, because we weren't the right party.
Right. But, you weren't the right kind of victim.
No. Even though, I'm listening to some of Harvey Weinstein doesn't deserve to breathe air. There's no question. But I'm listening to some of these things and I'm thinking, you know what Bill Clinton did to some of these people? It's so horrible. And we're sitting there talking about this, and these liberal women like Ashley Judd and these other people that have come forward, that's okay. But, you know, God forbid that one of us, you know, should tell our story. So that's pretty much where I am. I would say the healing process was long and arduous, and I backslid occasionally. But, you know, thank God I have my faith to see me through, and it always has, and I know it always will.
We have been talking, ladies and gentlemen, with Leslie Cruzan Milwee. You've heard her story, a powerful story, a frightening story, and yet at the same time, in its way, a very American story, because just like the Phoenix, she rose up from the ashes. She reinvented herself. It did not define her. It did not destroy her. Horrible as it was, and we're not going to take anything away from how horrific and how God, what a creep.
He really is. I mean, it's indescribable. It is.
I was listening to your interview with Don Ewen and Donna Fiducia, and I'm just stunned. I'm listening to it, and I know you're not lying. I know this is, but at the same time, I'm like, wow. And I had my tablet open, and because where I had the link that Don Ewen had sent me, and I just typed, I just went, Jesus. And he went, yeah, I know. And what you've done, I think, just like Kathleen Willey, just like Juanita Broderick, just like every one of these victims that have had the spine, that have had, you know, just stood up and said, you know what? No, this is what happened. I'm not going to keep quiet about it. I don't know about anybody else, but this is what happened to me. And
right.
All these voices singing in unison about what's happened here, at some point, you think it would reach critical mass. You think that at some point that it would turn the tide. And even if it never does, there's absolutely no questioning the courage that you ladies have in taking the stand that you have. Like I said, I'm really honored to have you here with us. It's a terrible story in many, many ways, but at the same time, you know, when we hear the end of it and how you came through it, it's a very inspiring and redeeming story as well. And we're happy to have had you with us this evening.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for sharing the story. And, you know, my goal in 2016 was, if I can educate one young woman who thinks Hillary Clinton is just awesome, let me tell you what her husband did. And not only did she allow it, she took up for that man. So that was kind of my reasoning, and I still believe that. I think they're a duo of evil.
Oh,
but,
sure. She enabled and protected him the entire way.
You know, just for her own political gain, which, you know, it took us many years and decades to see that roll out and what it entailed. But it became obvious, you know, their little pact to swap each other for the presidency and all these things. So, you know, it's really not a secret as things kind of came out, and I was forced to watch it unfold. But, you know, I'm okay with that, because he doesn't have power over me at all.
What a tremendous story. Again, we've been talking with Leslie Cruz and Milwee. She's told a story that I'm not even going to try to elaborate on, other than just how moved I am that you shared it with us. And we are happy to spread the word, to generate and maintain that level of awareness of just exactly what kind of people these are. Because the American public has a very short memory, and even as long a time span as the Clintons have been in the public eye, a lot of people forget about Vince Foster. A lot of people forget about Travelgate. They forget about Whitewater. They forget about, you know, any Clinton scandal you want to name. They kind of push that away, and they're encouraged to do so by the media, who's very quick to not pick any of that up, very quick to just walk by it and focus on something else and redirect. And when folks like you and Kathleen William, Juanita Broderick, I can't think of her
Paula
name
Jones.
Now, Paula.
Paula
Jones,
Paula
thank
Jones.
You very much. Paula Jones, you know, when you all stand up, and these stories haven't changed since they first came out. Juanita Broderick's story hasn't changed. Kathleen Willey's story hasn't changed. Your story, Paula Jones. And I'm in awe of you ladies. And once again, thank you so much for being on the program. And what's next for Leslie Cruz and Milwee? What do you, I know you have your daytime jobs. I know your career is that, but What else have you got in mind in terms of telling your story? Or
well, we, I say we, Juanita and Kathleen and I have aligned with several groups over the last couple of years. I speak occasionally at, you know, some conservative gatherings, and I've done that, and I speak to Republican women's groups, and you know, anyone that wants to hear my story, I'm happy to tell it. It needs to be told. There always
yes.
needs to be an awareness. That would be my main goal. I mean, obviously the ultimate goal would be this man in shackles walking across, you know, the television screen, but I live in the real world. So if I can A, help educate some of these, you know, it's like my kids, they don't remember any of that. They don't remember Monica Lewinsky. You know, they were babies. So,
right.
you know, these millennials, these kids growing up, if they're under 35 years old, they've heard the name, but they don't understand the story or know this. So if I can educate anyone that wants to know the reality of that, I am happy to share it.
Well, we're very happy that you shared it with us this evening. Is there a website where folks can get in touch with you in order to further this story?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I am at, I know everyone's going to say, I'm into, what do you call it? All the signs and stuff. I Astro Lover, astrology. But
astrology.
I am actually a Houston Astro fan. So I'm at Astro, A-S-T-R-O-L-U-V-R, Astro Lover. So you can follow me. You can send me messages if you want on Facebook. It's just Leslie Cruz and Milwee. I'm happy to speak and talk and share my story and local levels, national levels. I think it's important that we, you know what, you know who's waiting in the wings is Chelsea Clinton, and that in itself
yeah.
is another scary thing we have to deal with. So, you know, let's get rid of the Clinton dynasty, and I'll help people do that.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for being on the show this evening. We're glad that you spent the time with us. We will look forward to having you back someday. And
you
maybe
can.
On that day, we'll be talking about Bill Clinton's perp walk.
Wouldn't that be good? Okay. That sounds like a plan. Thank you so much for giving me the platform and letting me tell my story.
God bless you, Leslie. Thank you for sharing it with us, and we'll
you
be talking
too.
To you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Wow. Huh? How about that? Holy cats. You know what? I'm going to hit that. I've got to reconfigure here, man. I got to hit the reset button. Terrific stuff. Leslie Cruz and Milwee, another one of Bill Clinton's multiple creep victims. It's disgusting, but at the same time, like I said, it's so inspiring. All these women have picked themselves up and they survived it and they moved on. And not only that, they turned to face their victimizer and put a stop to all of it, took away all its control. We will be back with more of a conservative's perspective right after this.
Oh, when the sun beats down and burns the tar up on the roof, and your shoes get so hot, you wish your tired feet were fireproof. Under the boardwalk, down by the sea, yeah. On a blanket with my baby, that's where I'll be.
Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk.
Having some fun.
Under the boardwalk.
People walking above.
Under the boardwalk.
We'll be falling in love.
Under the boardwalk.
On the park you hear the happy sounds of a carousel. You can almost taste the hot dog and french fries.
boardwalk.
Out on the sidewalk.
Under the boardwalk.
We'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk.
People walking about.
Under the boardwalk.
We'll be falling in love.
Under the boardwalk. Boardwalk.
One at a time in here. We're mass communicating.
Hey, we're back. Conservatives' perspective here on the Patriot Nation Radio Network. Just an update. It's not going to be a whole lot longer till we get our man Mark Hoffman back in the saddle. El Guapo will be back, and he will be even más guapo than he was before he left. I promise you that. Won't be much longer. Wow, what a terrific, you know, I'm still, what a story, huh? What a fantastic story. And hopefully one day, you know, I do hope she comes back. I'd love to have her come back on the day that Clinton gets
perp walk for some of this stuff. But the reality of the situation is, you know, whatever judgment he's going to get isn't going to be here, I don't think. It's going to be the next level. And then that's a shame because I know there's a lot of people like, but what do you do? I don't know nothing. I just work here. Coronavirus. Everybody's gone crazy about the coronavirus, and the president's job approval rating has surged to the highest point of his presidency. Yes. Yes. Maybe not with the press. I don't think the press are that crazy about it. As a matter of fact, some of them have been whining and upset that maybe we shouldn't be showing too many of these press conferences because the guy looks too competent. No, I'm not making this crap up. How can you make this? You people are better acquainted with these clowns in the media than anybody else. On a plus note there, I still got some pork in it, and I think there's some things that, you know, it's in the end, it's money that's going to be spent in order to get money to do good. By the way, happy birthday, Nan. Yeah, Nancy Pelosi. Turns 80 today, and she was able to get a little bit of pork stuffed in the bill, but it was passed by the House and the Senate. It was, I suppose, to a certain extent, a good example of bipartisan work between the two. And, you know, sometimes things are just so polarized in Washington and throughout the country. And the reason that it's polarized is because there are some pretty radical polarizing forces out there to get the polarizing done. Oh, by the way, the president's approval rating is at the highest point of his presidency, and it's almost like 180 degrees opposite. The approval of how the press is handling the coronavirus scamdemic is. I think like about 40%. I mean, it just tanked them. But they don't care anymore than Nancy Pelosi. Nobody's going to take them off the air. CNN's not going anywhere. Rachel Maddow's not going anywhere. That idiot Lawrence O'Donnell is not going anywhere. None of those people that we despise and loathe and have disdain and contempt for because of their dishonesty, because of their complicity, because of their immense talent at being useful idiots for the Marxist left. Dry as dust. What are we talking about? Oh, the press. You know, they're in the toilet on this thing, and they're not changing a thing. They're upset. Because $25 million for national government radio was in this pork bill that was one of the things that, you know, that's going to help people with coronavirus is we're going to give $25 million to national government radio, who won't even run the press conferences that the president has to update the country as to the progress that's being made, as to the victories that are being won in this war against the coronavirus. And do you know why? It is because the media is pro-corona. They're pro-corona, okay? They were pro-Russian collusion. They were pro-obstruction of justice. They were pro-Bob Mueller. They were pro-quid pro quo. They were pro-Vindman. What was that guy's name? Adolf Vindman. Anything, they're pro anything that's anti-Trump. Let's just put it that way. So they've been pro all this stuff, and now they're pro. These people are actually rooting for the coronavirus. The New York Times says we can't restart the economy because coronavirus, which I think to this point has killed less than 300 people in the United States. That number may have gone up a little bit. I'm not sure. But right now it's right around. It's less than 300. The last time I looked at that statistic was 285. And there is a well, what's that much time? Okay, 10 after. We're good. And there is a school of thought, America, that, you know, this is a terrible, terrible disease. This is polio on wheels. This is the Asian flu. This is the Spanish flu. This is the swine flu. Nobody's upset because, like, where are the swine, the pro-swine people that are getting all jacked up about the fact that we call it the swine flu? You would think that the same people that are upset about it being called the Asian flu or the Chinese virus, by the way, COVID, China, say it with me, Chira, China-originated viral infectious disease. You guys left out the swine flu, man. Don't anybody say anything about swine flu. I guess that's okay, because I guess they're pigs or whatever, you know. You guys are beat up, man. So much for equality. But the coronavirus, as we have seen, and I don't want to take anything away from it. I know it's a real threat. It's a very icky disease, and it takes a very cruel toll, number one, on our elderly population. Number two, on those folks that are already sick with something. And number three, on the just plain old unlucky. And in this modern era, we can outwit many things, many, many things that once routinely killed people. But you know what? The Grim Reaper is still out there, and he will eventually get all of us. Some scary headlines have hinted that coronavirus is now the Grim Reaper's preferred method. Media reports have told us that coronavirus is significantly more deadly than the flu, which annually, which every year kills anywhere from 30 to 60,000 Americans. Excuse me. Hold on a minute. I've got the cotton now. Media reports have told us that coronavirus is significantly more deadly than the flu. It annually kills 30 to 60,000 Americans. Based on the speed with which it killed in China, Italy, Iran, and Spain, it looked as if the American death toll could easily top 2 million people annually. Well, while that's small potatoes compared to past pandemics, the plague of Justinian, the Black Death, the Spanish influenza, hey, you racist, cultural appropriating bendejos, it's a staggering toll in modern America. Okay, it would be. 2 million people. So at this point, just about any action seemed worthwhile to the United States to keep it from turning into a viral slaughterhouse. Well, that might not be what's happening. At the Wall Street Journal, Iran, Ben David, and Jay, holy cow, really? Bhattacharya, and we're not going to go back over it. Two medical professors at Stanford propose that possibly we're using the wrong math and that we're still missing the numbers we need to do this math correctly. However, by extrapolating from available data, one could make the argument that the coronavirus's mortality rate, the folks who are dying, is significantly lower than previously estimated. Now, according to the doctors, the true fatality rate is the portion of those infected who die, not the deaths from identified positive cases. Now, when calculating the mortality rate, we know the numerator, which is the number of folks who have died. While we know that number, we're using the wrong denominator. If the denominator is only those sick enough to get the test in the first place, that small number, of course, is going to return a much higher mortality rate. The real denominator should be the total number of people who catch this contagious virus. Ideally, we'd already be testing everyone with an antibody test, which would allow us to know how many have already caught this new virus and recovered without incident. maybe not even knowing we had it, maybe thought it was just a rough case of the flu. Hold on a minute. So while there are antibody tests in the pipeline and they're starting to say they're not there yet, on the other side, I mean. Thankfully, though, there is information that helps us estimate the contagion factor. In Italy, the scariest country of them all, the math says that while Italy is being slammed by the speed of the coronavirus' spread, the ultimate mortality rate, those folks who die, won't be as devastating as the early numbers predict. For example, and no, there's not going to be a quiz on this. The northeastern Italian town of Vo, near the provincial capital of Padua, take for example this town, on March 6th, all 3,300 people in this city were tested. 90 were positive, a prevalence of 2.7%. Applying that prevalence to the whole province, whose population was just a little shy of 1,955,000, which had 198 reported cases, suggests that there were actually 26,000 infections at the time. Now, that's more than a 130-fold increase in the number of actual reported cases. Since Italy's case fatality rate of 8%, and that's what they think, that's where they think they're at, because and the reason they think that is because it's estimated using the confirmed cases. But if we look at it from this math, where the Stanford, I'm not going to go through their names, where these two Stanford doctors have pitched it out, the real fatality rate versus those infected could in fact be a lot closer to 0.06. Now, what are they saying? Well, what they're saying is they're basing their numbers on the confirmed cases based on the tests that we have right now. But the truth of the matter is they'll get a better picture after these antibody tests have been administered. So if you use this same calculation like they used in Italy, which drastically dials back the number of fatalities. So they do this for other defined populations, such as airplanes that evacuated U.S. citizens from Wuhan, because all the passengers were tested, Iceland's population, and NBA players. Now, in the case of the Wuhan evacuees, only 0.9% of the Wuhan travelers tested positive. Extrapolating that data out to Wuhan as a whole would mean that 178,000 Wuhan residents were probably infected, a number 30 times greater than the number that China identified as having the virus. Now, accepting as true China's claim that it was only 3,287 folks that died, the real mortality rate would be 1.85%, which is still high, but it's a lot less than the original 4% which they were claiming. Math is so funny. But we still have this virus here in the United States. It generates a very real threat, again, to the elderly. I've got a mom that's 85 years old. I'm very concerned about making sure that we do what's necessary in her house, keep everything squared away, keep it nice and neat, keep it free from infection. Not mine, I got to watch myself. Same thing with my brother when, you know, we come to visit. It's also dangerous for the folks who are already sick. Well, these guys, based on their math and this, I'm not a doctor, but, you know, I'll go to one when I get sick enough. They suggest that the most sensible plan is to focus on the vulnerable populations. Validation. I've been saying this all along to my brother, who has a scientific background. And he does. He's a really smart guy, but he didn't buy into this. He was a panic button pusher. And Bernie, you're going to find out. Focus on the vulnerable populations, the folks that are already sick, and if they get this, it's going to complicate things and maybe put a period on their sins. The elderly, same thing. We want to watch them, whether it's in the hospitals, whether it's in the nursing homes, whether it's in their homes. This means isolating them, and because of the virus's rapid spread, temporarily reallocating resources like elective procedures. The bottom line on what they're talking about, based on the factors that apparently either folks have taken into consideration and rejected them because these particular numbers were not the numbers they were looking for to justify whatever it was that they felt like justifying, what we're seeing in truth is a markedly decrease in the fatality estimates. Take care of the people that are susceptible to it. Watch them, protect them. But as far as a universal quarantine, which there are people know a universal quarantine will destroy the economy, and that hurts everybody, it's a massive impact, and as a byproduct, it damages on a number of levels through physical and mental stress, the physical and mental well-being of Americans. It's most likely overkill, and it's got to be reevaluated. We cannot live in fear. And we must not be afraid to call out those people in places of authority who see this as a means of seizing power, who see this as a means of exerting their control over the liberties of the citizenry. And that cannot be allowed. America, that cannot be allowed. People died from the plain old garden variety flu last. 22,000 people here in America. Schools were not closed. Businesses were not shut down. The economy of this country did not come to a grinding halt while the Democrats rejoice. Not dead air, I'm still here just thinking about all this mess. There are people in this country absolutely, absolutely hurting. And, you know, I see the memes, well, conservatives love socialism, now they're handing out checks. These people closed their businesses and have, you know, endured this economic damage as a mandate of the government, not through any mismanagement or through any miscalculations on their part. It is a government mandate, and I think in this case, it is incumbent upon the government to make these people whole. These are beyond the circumstances of the control of these business owners, and these people are hurting. Democrats know this. Lots of restaurants in Democrat districts, lots of single moms, lots of convenience store workers, lots of beauticians, lots of nail techs. Everybody's hurting. And the Democrats, they just drag through it.
America is a land of heroes, a place where greatness is born, where destinies are forged, and where legends come to life. This is the home of Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt, of many great generals, including Washington, Pershing, Patton, and MacArthur. This is the home of Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Tubman, the Wright brothers, Neil Armstrong, and so many more. This is the country where children learn names like Wyatt Earp, Davy Crockett, and Annie Oakley. This is the place where the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth and where Texas Patriots made their last stand at the Alamo. The American nation was carved out of the vast frontier by the toughest, strongest, fiercest, and most determined men and women ever to walk on the face of the earth. Our ancestors braved the unknown, tamed the wilderness, settled the Wild West, lifted millions from poverty, disease, and hunger, vanquished tyranny and fascism, ushered the world to new heights of science and medicine, laid down the railroads, dug out the canals, raised up the skyscrapers. Our ancestors built the most exceptional republic ever to exist in all of human history, and we are making it greater than ever before. This is our glorious and magnificent inheritance. We are Americans. We are pioneers. We are the pathfinders. We settled the new world. We built the modern world. And we changed history forever by embracing the eternal truth that everyone is made equal by the hand of Almighty God. America is the place where anything can happen. America is the place where anyone can rise. And here, on this land, on this soil, on this continent, the most incredible dreams come true. This nation is our canvas, and this country is our masterpiece. We look at tomorrow and see unlimited frontiers just waiting to be explored. Our brightest discoveries are not yet known. Our most thrilling stories are not yet told. Our grandest journeys are not yet made. The American age, the American epic, the American adventure has only just begun. Our spirit is still young. The sun is still rising. God's grace is still shining. And my fellow Americans, the best is yet to come.
Just waiting to hear the Democrats who talk about this country the way the president does. And I'm going to be waiting for a while. Well, we're down to the end. This is it, the end of the line. We're done for this week with the conservative's perspective. We will be back on Tuesday, whole new ball of wax, looking at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. Tuesdays and Thursdays live, 7 p.m. Recorded version, Sundays, 4 p.m. Mojo50radio.com. If you're not listening, you ought to be. That's all the time we got. God bless you. God bless America. Stay safe out there. Wash your hands and cough into your elbow, man. We're going to get through it. It's going to be okay. 10 seconds. See you next week. Take care.